You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is the 1st of July 2016 and you are listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Once again today, I'm joined by the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story, Mr. Dennis Wise, and also Messerschmitt. How are you doing today, Dennis?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing this most important radio interview instead of watching football, but not a problem.
Well, it's Wales, I believe, are in the game today, so we do hope Wales win. But you never know, because you've given up your time to make this podcast, the good Lord may help Wales to win as some kind of repayment for you. And that would be good, but it's nice and sunny here where I am. Beautiful day, once again. It always does seem to be a beautiful day when we are recording this. And Messerschmitt, how are you doing today? Hello, Messerschmitt, are you there? He seems to have disappeared.
My apologies, I'm back. I have my microphone muted. So, yeah, I'm doing quite well, especially because of the good news we had. The Brexit succeeded, and today it was announced that Austria is going to have to re-vote.
Yeah, that's so fantastic.
That's excellent news.
Really good. They did say that they wanted to investigate all these postal votes, and it turns out that, we were 100% correct, and they had sent out fake postal votes, and it looks like, I think from what I saw, they said that the actual figure of the fake vote was roughly corresponding by the amount that the left won by, but I could only read it, I was seeing an English translation of it. Have you seen the actual German articles, Schmidt? Do you know more about
Not yet. I was looking at the Observer and I read the English article on it, but I think I will look into this more.
Yes, I expect you've been spending all your time revising and researching Leon de Grail for your segment this week.
Yeah, you could be right about that most of the time, yes. So I hope, should I get started already?
Yeah, sure. Dennis, have you got anything you'd like to say about this Austrian referendum?
This is my favourite general. I'm all ears.
Excellent. Okay.
Here we go. Leon de Grail, and most of the information in this presentation is from his wartime autobiography called Campaign in Russia, the Waffen-SS on the Eastern Front. He was born on June the 15th, 1906, in the town of Bouillon, in the Wallonia region of Belgium, into a family of devout Catholics. Bouillon is overlooked by Bouillon Castle, which once belonged to Godfrey of Bouillon, leader of the First Crusade and King of Jerusalem. In 1921, at the age of 15, he entered the Jesuit College of Notre-Dame de la Paix at Namur. At that age, he also started writing newspaper articles for Catholic publications. Next, he studied at the Catholic University of Louvain for a law doctorate, but also studying philosophy and literature there. In 1927, he assumed the direction of the student newspaper L'Avant-Garde, which, under his guidance, reached an unprecedented circulation of 10,000 copies. 2 years later, de Grail was offered an editorship of the Brussels daily newspaper Le XXe siècle, the 20th century, which he accepted as the agreement allowed him to continue his studies at the same time. And then in 1930, he was appointed director of Les Éditions Rex, a publishing house closely affiliated with the Catholic youth movement in Belgium. And Rex is the Latin for king and refers to Christ the King. At the age of 24, he was already an influential opinion leader and journalist in Belgium. Young Catholics started to rally to de Grail and the banner of Rex. And the story that then developed in the political landscape of Belgium is all too familiar to us, probably. De Grel and the Rexists pointed out the financial and moral corruption of the ruling powers. De Grel is credited by some even to have coined the term banksters. He certainly made it popular. He pointed out to the Belgian people that 59 Catholic deputies of the National Assembly held 245 positions on the boards of banking, industrial and commercial concerns, that 19 liberal deputies held 113 such positions, and that 17 socialists, all of them Marxists, held 53 of these. He also remarked on how the ruling parties were only able to hang on to power by fostering political division and strife. And the Belgian people actually began to wake up to reality. Because when the Rexist party first ventured into the election process in 1936, they had a stunning success. 21 deputies and 12 senators from the movement were elected. The establishment reacted by uniting all the parties from the extreme left to the so-called conservatives in a massive front against the only party that had the best interests of the whole nation at heart. The controlled mainstream press and even the Catholic hierarchy in the person of Cardinal Van Rooy joined this front. Catholics were forbidden by him from even abstaining from voting for the establishment candidate for prime minister, Paul van Zeeland. And of course, that made him, Zeeland, win the elections. A year later, he was, however, forced from office in the spring of 36 because De Grel had publicized the details of a financial scandal in which Van Zeeland was involved in. After the usual damage control and spinning by the mainstream media, though, he was reinstated by June. The Van Zeeland government then declared martial law and brutally suppressed the Rexists. After the war, Van Zeeland was one of the founders of the European League for Economic Cooperation, which promoted the forming of what we know today as the EU. He was also honorary secretary general of the steering committee of the Bilderberg Group. And if you just heard an echo when I said Bilderberg Group, then it was all in your mind. In the mid to late 1930s, De Grel met with Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, José Antonio Primo de Rivera of the Spanish phalanx, and Corneliu Zelea Codreanu of the Romanian Iron Guard. Then, when the German army advanced into Belgium to get to France after France had declared war on Germany, bypassing the Maginot Line, De Grel was arrested by the Belgians as a suspected collaborator, beaten and tortured, and he and dozens of other Belgian political prisoners were sent to France. The only reason De Grel survived the following massacre at Abbeville, where French army soldiers murdered these prisoners without any sort of trial, was that French soldiers had recognized him on the lorries and had taken him off the convoy to beat him up. The convoy continued without De Grel, and he was put into a French concentration camp instead. After Germany had won the France campaign, he was liberated by the Germans and able to go home to Belgium. And then later, when the war against the Soviet Union started, De Grel decided to join the fight. He had been ardently anti-Bolshevik anyway and saw how dangerous the aggressively expanding Soviet Union was for Europe. And his offer to raise a volunteer battalion of his Walloons, remember he came from the Wallonia region of Belgium, for the struggle in the East was accepted by the Germans. Until that point, De Grel had never fired a gun and had no military training at all. The offer by the Germans to give him a high rank from the start was declined by him, and he insisted on starting out as a rank and file soldier, sharing all the burdens of his comrades. He and his men arrived at the Eastern Front in November 1941. They were immediately impressed by the sheer size of the Ukrainian steppe and also by the gigantic amount of war material that was either lying destroyed near the roadside or in the fields or had been captured intact from the fleeing Bolshevik army. Another shock to them was when they witnessed what the actual progress of the Soviet state was when it came to providing housing and infrastructure for the citizens. And this, by the way, is an impression I have come across again and again while reading these wartime biographies. When they came to the Ukrainian city Dnipropetrovsk, they saw that what de Grel describes in his own words here, and it's going to be a rather long quote, but I think it's quite informative. Quote, at Dnipropetrovsk, the Stalin regime had made great efforts in construction. We were at first impressed as we approached the suburbs of the city, where we saw outlined the large masonry blocks of the proletarian housing erected by the Soviets. Their lines were modern, the buildings were huge, and there were many of them. Undeniably, the communist system had done something for the people. If the misery of the peasants was great, at least the workers seemed to have benefited from the new times. Still, it was necessary to visit and examine the buildings. We lived for 6 months in the Donetsk coal basin. We had plenty of time to test the conclusions that we had reached at the time of our entrance into Dnipropetrovsk. The buildings, so impressive from a distance, were just a gigantic hoax, intended to fool sightseers, shepherded by in-tourists and the viewers of documentary films. Approaching these housing blocks, you were sickened by the stench of mud and excrement which rose from the quagmires surrounding each of the buildings. Around them were neither sidewalks nor gravel nor paving stones. The Russian mud was everywhere. And everywhere the walls peeled and crumbled. The quality of the construction materials was of the lowest order. All the balconies had come loose and already the cement stairways were worn and grooved, although the buildings were only a few years old. Each floor had a certain number of apartments that were whitewashed and provided with a minuscule kitchen for the use of several families. The electric wiring hung in clusters. The walls were made of mud and cracked as soon as you dared to pound a nail into them. Generally, there was no running water. The proletarian dwellers, not able to use the sanitary facilities, relieved themselves all around the buildings, converted as a result into a vast latrine. Cold weather froze the droppings, which with each thaw caused a terrible stench. Altogether, those apartments turned out to be more uncomfortable than the miserable izbas in which, that's a Ukrainian word, it's like a peasant's hut, izba, in which on the richest soil in Europe, millions of Russian peasants vegetated in the midst of a sordid misery. Only tattered clothes on their backs, eating from a common bowl using spoons crudely carved from bits of wood. 75% of our soldiers were manual laborers. Many among them had been susceptible once to Soviet propaganda. They stood with their mouth agape when they saw in what condition of decay and exhaustion the Russian proletariat existed. They shook their heads, having to look twice at the scene before believing it. Hitler had tried a dangerous experiment. The hundreds of thousands of German workers mobilized and sent to the Eastern Front could have made dangerous comparisons if the Soviets had actually achieved great things for the working class. On the contrary, every German thought back to his delightful workers' housing in the Reich, to its comfort, to the family garden, to the clinics and maternity hospitals for the people, the leisure time, the paid vacations, the magnificent cruises to Scandinavia or to the Mediterranean. They remembered their wives, their children, happy, in good health, well-clothed. Looking at the ragged Russian people, the miserable izbas, the workers' apartments, gloomy and rickety, they drew clear conclusions. Never had workers' group made such a study trip. 4 years later, the comparison worked in the opposite direction. After having looted the watches, the jewelry, the clothes from all of Eastern Europe, the Soviet soldier returned grumbling to the USSR, astonished at the comfort of the non-communist countries and disgusted with his paradise of wooden spoons, tattered dresses and muddy excrement stretching around his house barracks, end quote.
That's pretty shocking, isn't it? Really, really shocking. That's like third world conditions. That's, you know, like India, where they just don't have any latrines and just go outside. It sounds to me like that's almost like a Hollywood film set from the Wild West with a cardboard cutout intended to just deceive people that it's a street, that it's buildings. So that was put there for journalists, I suppose. Maybe also for the advancing army, so that they would think that there was lots of people living there. And it's not something you really think of a government doing, is it, really?
Yes, and actually, de Grel, what he says, he uses the word, it was made for in tourist. That is that was the Soviet organization responsible for the tourist industry, if they had any, you know, ferrying around the tourists, showing them only what they're allowed to see. So this was made for those who, came to Russia to get an impression, but they were, of course, never let close to the houses or even into them.
Yeah, that's really shocking. We'll deal with a part of that later on when we look at part 19 of Communism by the Back Door. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that last bit, or have you got any more to go? Schmidt, is there more to go from your piece this week?
Yes, not long, a few minutes, 2-3 minutes.
Okay, maybe we'll comment after that if you'd like to continue.
All right. He also talks about the peasants he encountered in the small villages and the abject poverty in which they lived. Almost all of the better-off farmers had been sent to the labor camps in Siberia. Despite the persecution of Christians, however, these poor peasants clung to Christianity as best they could. All the churches de Grel came across in his years at the front were desecrated, used as stables, garages, or storage places. For the first few months, the balloons were serving behind the front lines, guarding against partisan attacks and sabotage. After winter had set in, the first combat casualties among de Grel's men occurred when they were ordered to attack Soviet bunkers across a frozen river. They did take the bunkers, but as I said, he lost a number of his comrades there. In spite of the horrors, misery, and toils of what de Grel, of that war, de Grel had a remarkable ability to perceive beauty. And as one of his talents lay in writing, he was able to describe it very well and in poetic manner. And as a quick example, quote, "Nevertheless, the country was still pleasant to see. The great white steppe was cross-hatched with hundreds of thousands of gray sunflower stalks. Clouds of sparrows, like little balls of fleece, fluttered madly aloft. The sky especially was admirable, as pure as crystal, pale blue, so clear that each tree's bare branches were outlined against the horizon with a sharpness worthy of the Acropolis in Athens," end quote. And well, with that impression, I have come to the end of the first part. Next week, we will hear more about what he experienced at the Eastern Front.
Yeah, that's certainly shocking conditions that the communists were in. To go back to the beginning there, with the beginning of his life, was he always a nationalist? Or was he inspired by what he saw happening in Germany? Did he start out like that?
Well, he was primarily a Catholic and patriot, yes. And I have read no indication that he ever fell for leftist or liberal ideologies. He seems to have been straightforward. If you are Catholic, you are naturally conservative. But I think he was from start. He was very patriotic, and he was anti-Bolshevik from early age on as well.
And yet the Catholics tried to ban people from joining him, despite the fact that he was quite proud of his Catholic beliefs, and the organization that he formed was Catholic as well, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And, well, he got into the trouble because he pointed out that the Catholics were also involved in the corruption in Belgium, political corruption, having all these, I don't know the technical term, but they were responsible for industry and banking, administration. And they were bribable through that. They were corruptible through that. He pointed that out, and many different scandals he pointed out in his newspaper publications. Of course, the people in power didn't like that, whether they were Catholic or not.
Well, so it's interesting to find out that there was more to him than just the guy that fought in the Waffen-SS and survived the war and spoke about National Socialist Germany. It's interesting to hear about his life leading up to that point. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
Yeah, well, like I said earlier, he's my all-time favourite general. There's some quite interesting videos on YouTube that I urge people to go and listen to, because the guy, once he escaped to Spain after the war, did some excellent reviews on National Socialism and the SS, etc. And it doesn't come as no surprise to me that he didn't want the luxury of going into the army at a higher rank, and instead went in as a foot soldier. Very similar to Adolf Hitler, who did the same in World War One. And this, of course, is the guy who Adolf Hitler stated that if he ever had a son, then Leon de Grel, he would like him to be just like Leon de Grel, which is an absolute wonderful statement coming from the Führer.
Yeah, that's quite an honour. It's interesting to hear that he met Mussolini and Hitler and Codriano, and I dare say a few other leaders of nationalist movements at the time. You think today it's you get to meet the people that do lead these movements. You know, they're real people that want to meet other nationalists. They're not like these politicians that hide away, that don't want to meet the people, that have all these bodyguards in front of them, or in the case of Obama, a great big tank and a bulletproof wall in front of them. And these people wanted to meet the people that they were fighting for. They were like the focal point of the nation. I believe they would channel the energy of that nation into trying to achieve something positive for it. And I thought another interesting part there that you brought up, Schmidt, was the corrupt politician that was part of Belgium before the war, and then after the war was one of the architects of the EU. I think that just shows you that the plan for the European Union goes way back. It goes back to before the war, and that they just seized upon the fallout after the war as a good means to use in order to bring about the EU, to use that as the excuse, saying, well, we need the European Union to ensure that we always have peace between the countries. Whereas the real planning for it was to have an overarching government of unelected bureaucrats working for the bankers, really, over a slave class. So it shows you that it was planned right the way from the beginning. Why they let him back in after he was found to be corrupt, I don't know. Maybe they said that it was just a Nazi slurs against him or something like that. Do you know more about that character at all, Schmidt?
Not really. I did research him a little, but most of what I could find was on Wikipedia. And, I don't know what the exact financial scandal was and how the press exactly spun it so that he could be reinstated later. But obviously it was serious enough that he had to resign. And, well, probably the mainstream media worked very similarly back then as it does today. So they just spun the whole story. And after a lot of people had forgotten about it, they just reinstated him. Is what I'm guessing happened.
Like a lot of the crooks and the criminals of World War II that were removed from their positions by the National Socialists and the Nationalist regimes after the war, they came back and they were given all the plum positions, like in East Germany, and some of them were even involved in the Nuremberg court on the side of the prosecutors where they shouldn't have been. Well, you're not supposed to judge any case that actually involves yourself in it. And the point I was going to refer to about the conditions that the communists were living in, I thought that bore some relevance to part 19 of Communism by the Backdoor, Dennis, where you had that letter that was sent out saying that they were going to cover up the crimes of the Red Army. And admitting that they knew that these crimes actually did take place, but you had this Stafford Cripps, the ambassador to the Soviet Union, saying there was no wish to interfere in any other country. I mean, he had obviously been out there in the Soviet Union, and he must have been shown these false house fronts. He must have known about them, and yet he blatantly lied to the people. I thought that was a really interesting part from that. I'd urge everyone to go out and see part 19. Did you find out anything more about this character, Stafford Cripps, ambassador to the Soviet Union?
Well, apparently, I think he was moved in 1942. Either he got relegated or he got dismissed or something. But he only lasted up to 1942. We're quite sure what you're saying about him going over to the Soviet Union. Meeting Stalin. And don't forget, of course, that the West were funding Soviet Union anyway at that time. So they wouldn't have known exactly what was going on over there.
Yeah, they knew the crimes of the Bolshevik regime, and yet they chose to turn a blind eye to it and instead to make up crimes of the Germans. That admits that in that letter. The letter from signed by H. Hewitt, Assistant Secretary of the Ministry. I forget what the exact ministry was.
Information at the time, it was, yeah.
Ministry of Information, sent out to the churches. And it's admitting it all, isn't it?
Yeah. And the BBC fell in line as well. So consequently, all the documentaries that have been made over the years have all been geared to steering away everybody from the actual Soviet crimes and then making up the crimes of the Germans and the Japanese as well, they mentioned.
And these lies that they told to get away with it, I see you've got a few of them on there. You've got somebody saying, oh, I have first-hand knowledge that they were turned into soap. Now I've had experience with older people that are very adamant that the Holocaust happened. And, you know, I say, well, what is your evidence for this? What's your evidence that this actually happened? And they say, well, we knew Jews that escaped from it. And they told us about it. Yeah. And you know, they wouldn't lie. They were good people. They wouldn't lie. But, you know, they obviously did lie. And they're very, very accomplished liars. And this is why people fell for it. Is because they are such good liars. I mean, we can see the proof today. There was no soap. There was no shrunken heads. There was no gassings. There's never been an autopsy done on anyone that was gassed during World War II. And yet we have a generation of people that actually believed this. Because the people that so-called escaped, the refugees, when they came to Britain, they told these lies. They repeated the same lies. I think, wasn't sure if that was actually a Jew in your documentary part there, or whether that was somebody English who had heard that from a Jew. Because that's what it reminded me of. An Englishman that had heard it from a Jew and was adamant that was the truth. And of course, where we're so honourable people, if we think somebody is telling the truth, we defend them. This is why we have people that, pretty much worship the Jews and won't hear a bad word said against them, because they actually believe that all this was true. They believe that this horrific thing happened, don't they?
Even today, I mean, there was a comment earlier this week on YouTube asking what have the Jews ever done, and kind of listed quite a number of things. And where they could be checked out, and you know, people don't. Because I think a lot of it's got to do with controlling the press. What people don't understand, they can't understand that the Jews in unison actually all lied, and the carrot what was dangling in front of them was the reparations, the Holocaust pension. and they weren't going to turn that down. And even this week, somebody has come out in America that they've been caught out, and they admitted that they never went to Auschwitz. And although he spent a lifetime telling everybody of the horrors in Auschwitz, he's found out. And that's just one. You know, well, yeah. There's many people.
So. Yeah, well, he admitted it, didn't he? He said his reasons for doing so was because he didn't like people that doubted the truth of it. So, you know, if you don't like people that doubt the truth of it, you don't make up a lie. You highlight that what you believe is to be the truth. But he wasn't doing that. He was making up lies about it. We discussed that in a podcast earlier this week. I noticed you had another famous traitor on there, a traitor of the moment, which is this, let me get his name right here, Martin Schulz, the EU president. I believe he's also president or prime minister of Germany. I think he's the one that was chased down the other day by the German people.
He's president of the EU and all that.
Yeah, he said that it wasn't the elites that were causing the problems; it was the German people. So they literally chased him down the other day. They booed him off the stage. Chased him down the road. The police had to shelter around him to protect him. And who do we see shaking hands with him, desperate to do deals with him, but Nicola Sturgeon from Scotland, the traitor. That's her new friend, this big traitor to the German people.
Yeah, I don't think she's going to get away, though. Well, you know, I think Spain's come out and said that they would be against Scotland staying in the EU. You know, the British Isles had voted, and they should stick to what they voted, which is fair enough. But yeah, you know, how could you call it a nationalist? It's impossible.
I don't understand that either. But one thing to do with this that I have noticed, Michael Gove has put himself in for Prime Minister, which I think is good. But nobody's highlighting the fact that he's Scottish. And we need somebody to unite the country, and he could very well do that because he's Scottish. But they don't want him to be Prime Minister because he's spoken out against immigration. He dropped Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson made a speech saying, oh, well, we have to allow free movement. We can't possibly stop that. The very next day, Michael Gove dropped Boris Johnson, put himself up to be Prime Minister. And of course, the BBC and all the newspapers are saying, oh, no, we should have Theresa May. We should have Theresa May. And they're not talking about Gove. And Gove did a speech today. And again, he reiterated the fact that we have to control our borders. We have to get immigration down to the tens of thousands, nowhere near what it is today, which is the hundreds of thousands. So he's basically sticking to what he actually said. So they obviously don't want him in. So because if they wanted him in, they just point out, well, he's Scottish. Surely if we had a Scottish Prime Minister, that might help to heal the rift between the English and the Welsh and the Scots. The Scots are saying they don't want to be in or they want to stay in the EU, and they're not sure that Britain is going to look after their interests. Well, surely if we had a Scottish Prime Minister, he would want to look out for their interests, wouldn't he?
Well, the interesting thing is that Nigel Farage, who I actually saw having a bit of a ding-dong with Schulz on YouTube, he's now a little bit worried and a little bit nervous that a lot of, you know, main people who had been with the Leave campaign have now gone a little bit soft. Boris Johnson was one of them. And he's worried now that they're going to drag the feet, you know, to come out. I'm not saying they're not going to come out, but he fears that covertly there could be some deals done to keep, you know, some kind of foot in Europe. And when you think about it, when they're looking to have a European army and you know, other things down the line, then it would be in the interests of the Rothschilds to keep Britain with that one foot in Europe. So we've got to be very careful now, especially with the immigration as well, because like you just mentioned about monitoring on the immigration, going back on the word, obviously, you know, the agenda is still to flood Britain with immigrants and mongrelise the complete nation. And so, you know, people will have that agenda in mind and still be, because we don't know how many, what the real amount is. Cameron, I thought, you know, was never upfront and honest. There was people coming in the back door. I'm quite convinced and more over here than most people realise. And was the reason why so many people voted out, because they're in contact with that many. So it's a dubious time. We know what they're like. You know, they fix results. You know, the benches are, you know, as they come. So we've got to keep an eye out for them. Like, you know, I'm as concerned as what, Nigel Farage is, to be honest. When I think about it, the people in power they didn't want to leave. And if they didn't want to leave, they're going to try and do whatever they can.
Well, this is why you've got to have somebody as Prime Minister who is standing up for the people that wanted to leave. You can't have Theresa May there who said, oh, well, we haven't got a problem with immigration. We haven't got a problem with defending our borders. And I'm not going to take part in the campaign to leave. You can't put her in charge of withdrawing from the EU because chances are she's going to sabotage it or she's going to try and fix it so that we stay in. I mean, Michael Gove appears to be a man of his word. He spoke up about the leftist narrative over World War One and how that was untrue. He's done quite a few patriotic things in the past, and he is quite conservative, although he does claim to be a Zionist. But he's still the lesser of all the evils.
Yeah.
You know, and you're quite right, Dennis. What we've got to do now is make sure that they actually stick to their word. And that's why we need Nigel Farage to stay there in the forefront. He should really be knighted so that he can join the House of Lords and have his say there. If we can't make him Prime Minister. But I think Michael Gove, obviously the press and the BBC don't want him in there. But if we can get it so that he is the two that get picked, because the Conservative Party pick a choice of two leaders from all the hopefuls, and then they hand that vote out to the members of the Conservative Party. And the members of the Conservative Party are fairly conservative. They weren't happy with David Cameron's gay marriage and promotion of homosexuality. They weren't happy about a lot of things that David Cameron did. So hopefully, you know, if it's a choice between Theresa May and Michael Gove, then, you know, we've just got to pray that they do pick Gove, because he will be better. And we've just got to highlight it.
There's a power behind the scenes somewhere which was always pushing us into Europe and going down that, you know, agenda of communist state. So that power's still around, and this is what you've got to watch out for, because I'm quite sure they were taken aback at the results, and they probably did all they could to stop it as well and failed. So they'll be looking for other ways.
Well, they'll be trying to punish us and trying to encourage other countries not to go the same way. I mean, the leaders of the EU, I saw on Russia Today, who have been, you know, quite pro-splitting from the EU, they've been quoting some of the leaders today saying as how there can be no more referendums in Europe, because the public cannot be trusted with such important decisions. We must
let the copy still front there.
Yeah. Well, they're getting quite open about it now. And this is what you've been exposing in your documentary series. But I hear you've been working on something else to do with that this week. Is it a promotional video or something, Dennis?
Yeah, well, we have one for the Adolf Hitler one, and so we're looking. Hopefully, we're going to have it ended shortly, and then there'll be enough time to package it and get it on sale before Christmas. This is the idea. And so I was looking to do a promo while I was taking a break from doing part 20. And I've almost finished it. We've almost, I think it may even be up tonight. But in doing that, I've also been researching at the same time. And one or two things came to mind. One I can tell you about is, amazingly enough, I came across this YouTube video. How can I explain this now? You know, at Omaha Beach at Normandy, I've always said it, when all them Allied soldiers landed, they thought they were trying to get rid of this monster called Adolf Hitler, and all the time, not being known to them, they were actually saving communism and going to aid Stalin. Now, consequently, what's happened is at Omaha Beach, it's actually now American territory, and it's a little bit of a museum thing. You've got to go through like a bit of a check at the door with the American soldiers and all this. And, but they've got all the graves there, you know, of all the people what died, who landed on that beach without air cover, by the way. Lo and behold, what do we have on the grounds but a huge symbol of the original communist emblem and Illuminati emblem, which Roosevelt put on the back of the dollar, a huge round pyramid with the eye and the New World Order in Latin written on it, which just goes to show what I was saying all along, was that those guys unwittingly died for the New World Order, which is communist.
So that's at Omaha Beach, is it?
Uh-huh.
Like a big sculpture.
It's set in a building of a wall. They've got a few Masonic structures around there, and like I said, I put it in the promo, and it's just tells you everything. It's just, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, what's a New World Order pyramid with an eye doing over the soldiers what died at Normandy?
They do like to put their stamp everywhere, their autograph. I mean, when I see those the wind turbines, that to me is like them putting their stamp in the middle of the countryside. Look, we're here. We own this. You know, there's nowhere you can get away from us. You can't even get your vision away from us. You all see us here. That's what it seems more like to me than anything else. I mean, the turbines don't turn. They don't produce any electricity. The wind's blowing and they're still. And when the wind's not blowing, they're turning. They're absolutely pointless. All they are is a reminder that the state has reached right out into the countryside and there is nowhere you can go to escape it. Now, that's what it means to me, let alone the esoteric ones like the pyramid and the all-seeing eye and the Masonic symbols that we see everywhere. At least they can't brand you on the inside with them. That's what matters. But one thing that's I found quite emotional today is it's the anniversary of the Battle of the Somme. And they've been telling me about the soldiers, these young soldiers that went to war, and they were all laughing and in high spirits, and you know, really not prepared for what they saw, where the weapons of war had progressed since the last time there'd been any battles. I mean, it was quite horrific, seeing people blown to pieces and the trees blown to pieces, no birds singing. Thousands of them just dying due to this machine gun fire, just fodder, basically, to die. You imagine these young men and the camaraderie between them, and they all thought they were going to fight to die for their country, to die for their nation. You know, they loved their nation, they loved their country, they loved their king so much that they were prepared to die for those three things. And yet what they were really dying for was for the banks, was for these Jewish usurers. That's who it was really for. It just really, you know, made me quite emotional thinking of, these people just go brave young men just going off to their deaths to serve the enemy. And it makes me all the more strengthened today to speak out about it, you know, and to speak up.
I can go another level on that one if you want.
Please do.
What I saw was the blocking units of the Soviet Union in Second World War, when they had the machine guns behind the Soviet soldiers, and anybody who decided, I've had enough of this, I'm going to retreat, obviously, was taken out with the blocking unit. Very similar to World War One, by the way, where if you didn't go over that wall, you were lined up and you were executed. There's not much difference in that Bolshevik mentality in World War One and, well, World War Two, into what the British Army had in World War One.
Well, that's deserters, isn't it? You know, you've got to obey orders. You had got to obey orders. But the difference with the Soviets was that they refused to take back any prisoners of war, and they said, "We're going to kill your family as well if you disobey orders."
I'll ask you a question, though, Sven. If you know when you go over that wall, you know, you just had, you know, a dozen of your mates killed, if you're going to get killed, are you going to go over that wall?
Oh, this is just it. This is what drove them over that wall was the love for their country, their nation, and their king. And they thought they were defending their country, didn't they?
I don't know. I think, you know, a lot of it had to do with them being bored. Some of them were, you know, not real life anymore. There's a bit of excitement going abroad. I'll give you that. But I think a lot of it has to do going over that wall, you know, with a guy behind him with a gun.
Well, it must have been a shock once they got there, as I said. But they did go away in these high spirits. You had youngsters that were under the age of 16 that were telling the army recruiters that they were over 18 so that they could get in and fight. They were so keen to fight. You know, it's the power of this propaganda, telling them about the evil Hun that was going to come to Britain and invade Britain if they didn't go there and defend the country. You know, it really shows you the power of propaganda, doesn't it?
It's difficult because he played football at Christmas time, so there must have been some humane, you know, part of people, but not that I agreed with that.
Well, Hitler spoke about that, didn't he? He didn't agree with that. You know, they were fighting. It was a life and death matter. It wasn't a time for playing football. You know, it had to be taken seriously. You can see his point of view as well. You've got young men that are dying there. Let's get this over as quickly as possible. Which side wins?
You're going to pass the ball 1 minute to somebody, or tackle somebody, should I say? And tomorrow you're going to have to shoot them. It just doesn't make any sense, you know.
You've got football on the mind, haven't you, Dennis?
Not as much as I used to, I'm going to be honest.
Well, at least it encourages a patriotic feeling. It's just a shame that these football teams now are all multicultural. It was amazing the other day. Did you see the Vikings won? The all-white Icelandic team won? They're making
someone like Sterling messed up.
And I don't really watch football myself, but, you know, you've got to look at it and think, well, you know, the Germans won with an all-white team in the last cup, and the Icelanders won with an all-white team against the multicultural ones, and they've been saying, oh, well, Iceland is such a small country, and look, yet it won this game. Well, the reason it won the game is because they're all white. You can't expect geese, swans, and ducks all to fly in formation together. You know, birds of a feather flock together.
This is going to gut you, though. The first German black player scored.
But how do they, you know, how are they going to work as a team together when you've got other races on your team?
I mean, when you look back a few years ago, when an Italian side came out, they played in a certain way. And again, this year, they're playing that way. Well, that's because they got, you know, majority of what I call Italians in the side. But what happens is they bring up these other, like I said, Turkey, you know, there's a lot of Turks now in Germany and, you know, other races mixed in other countries, and it changes the culture and the style of the football, because the Italians have always played a certain way and Germans have always played a certain way, and that over the next few generations, that's going to change. I mean, I watched a YouTube video of the referendum party. I don't know if you can remember them. They're back in the 70s, who solely stood to come out of the EU, because they could say exactly where it was going. And the promotional video they made, I believe the leader of the party actually forked out for himself. I think it was Goldsmith, one of the multimillionaire rich families who didn't agree with communism, and kind of posted it out to all households all over Britain. And it's absolutely bang on. It showed exactly what the EU was going to be. It's going to have one national anthem. It was going to have one flag. It's going to have one currency. And, you know, just open borders of this one huge state. Exactly the road it was going down. And so it is going to spell football eventually, because what's going to happen in time is that you're going to have mongrelized nations all running around playing the same kind of football and probably not as good.
Well, they won't be as good. And just thinking about the football violence as well. I mean, did we have football violence back before we had multicultural teams? Do you know?
I don't rightly think that had a lot to do with it. I mean, Russia were quite violent this year, but again, I saw another YouTube video in Russia, where they'd arranged to have a fight with the immigrants. So they all lined up in a street like, and they all got ready, and then they all went to war. And these immigrants were all battered and beaten. And the same thing apparently happened in the Euros, because when the Russians, when the football violence broke out, they were far more organised than what anybody else was. And if you remember, the British hooligans back in the 80s used to be more organised abroad than anybody. But consequently, over the past couple of decades, where, you know, that kind of thing has died down now in England, and you know, you've got to sit down, watch your game, and it's killed all the kind of the chanting behind the goals and everything. So they were probably caught, certainly they were, by this organised Russian attack in the first game.
Well, yeah, British football hooligans had quite a fearsome reputation, especially in the 70s and the 80s. So the Russians were obviously trying to take that crown, as it were. And during that time, we've been propagandized and brainwashed and feminized. So our football fans just didn't know what hit them when the Russians came after them. It's just a shame that it comes out in that way. I mean, really, it should be against our enemies, not against our own people.
Well, if you look at it from the Russian point of view, I mean, if you put yourself in their shoes and you're looking at Britain and a number of nations now in Europe who have men marrying men, they're going to look at us as quite strange, because I would, if I was on the Russian side, looking out. Not that I don't think that anyway, you know.
Well, yeah, they'd be seeing themselves as the holders of morality and going up against these decadent, sinful perverts, basically. I suppose you've also got to think about the propaganda that they see and hear coming from Britain, which is constantly running Russia down, constantly echoing what comes from America. So you should imagine there was quite some patriotic feeling in that when they actually went for the British football fans, because we are at the front of running Putin down, aren't we?
Well, exactly. They were demonising him as a second Hitler. I think even Prince Charles called him that, didn't he?
I don't know. They're always calling people the second Hitler. Let's get back to communism by the back door then, Dennis. How many parts do you think this is going to have now? Do you think you're coming up near to the final instalment?
I was just going to say, I found a couple of things this week. Obviously, I've told you about one, but I found another one which I'm going to end the part on. It's pretty earth-shattering. Kind of ends all arguments. This is my opinion. And it's set in stone. There's no way around it. There's no argument around it whatsoever. And kind of defeats all the arguments that we've had over the years with these people who are defending the Allies. This particular find this week will kill them arguments dead, I'm convinced.
So this is going to be, it's got quite some finale that you've got planned for us then.
And I stumbled on it this week, yes. And I couldn't believe what I found. And I couldn't believe that it hasn't been discovered before. And I couldn't believe that it is absolutely waterproof.
So how long do you think we've got to wait until that comes out?
Well, I'm hoping that probably it could be this next episode. I mean, I've started on part 20 last week just to get the preparations right. And what I thought was going to take up most of it is not going to take it all up. So it could well be the last part. I don't know for sure. But if not this one, then more likely the one after it. But I can tell you for sure, you will rock, Sven. You really will.
Well, I look forward to that then. I mean, this is the thing. You always come across more information, more evidence to add to the story, to trying to convince people. So yeah, I will be interesting to see how you tie all the loose ends up and how it finally ends, because you have really sort of told the whole story, really. I mean, going right back to Babylon and the multiculturalism that went on there and the way that the state controlled things through the ages, going through the revolutions, finally ending up in the communist revolution. There's always been this group of figures that seeked to control people. And a lot of it has been through the propaganda. I mean, even going back to the Egyptian priests, I mean, they could write these hieroglyphs, and they were the only ones that could read these hieroglyphs. So they could, you know, secretly speak to one another with them and keep this knowledge away from the average people and away from the average slaves. And they could also put, I mean, I've seen propaganda up there showing that Akhenaten was a really good family man. Have you seen these pictures? Akhenaten, the pharaoh, he's there with the family, he's worshipping the sun, he's all this bountiful food around him and all this pleasure, and he built this big golden city. And yet there's these mass graves there of all these kids, malnourished kids with bone diseases. And yet the pictures of him, the propaganda, were, you know, shown him to be this really nice guy living in this paradise. It's the same as, you know, the workers' paradise, communist workers' paradise, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, you could say I'm doing this particular DVD and the Adolf Hitler one for mankind, because if they ever do get the chance of dumbing down Europe, and they will do, you know, they'll race mix the best they can. They'll give us the least education so that, you know, we're not aware of what actually is and what should be. At least these, you know, if people manage to get hold of an hard copy and download it from the internet, they will have these episodes to pass on to their siblings and tell the real truth, because I'm quite sure when they go to school, they're never going to hear anything like this.
Well, they'll be able to challenge what they do actually here at school after watching them. Both series have been real eye-openers. They really do change the way that you look at things. And I believe the most important people that we need to bring to this truth are the conspiracy types. And I think, you know, this second series of yours is probably will appeal to them more. And once they see that, then they'll go back and look at Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told.
That's right. That's right. Plus, I don't think it'll get banned the same as the one, because the other one was kind of in your face, where this one is running pretty much ban-free at the moment. And, you know, Facebook didn't allow Adolf Hitler. And let me just say about Wikipedia, by the way. Wikipedia have banned it as well. There's no link to it. It's got a list of greatest stories, you know, which have been made throughout time. And the one without the link is the Adolf Hitler one. And I saw a previous list of that a while back. They said it was just Nazi propaganda. So obviously it's controlled by Zionists. But yeah, these series of episodes in both these documentaries, I think can be looked on in time and shown to people, you know, that this is what it's really all about.
So they won't give you a link to it then on Wikipedia. Have they got anything about Dennis Wise on there, or do they actually mention the documentary series?
No, nothing really, which is fine, you know.
Well, maybe you should get somebody to start adding it.
But it just gets taken off anyway, because it was up there originally, the link, I know it was, and it just gets taken off, you know, because like the iPad, there's a YouTube video to prove that as well. You just put in YouTube, Jews run Wikipedia, and they're admitting it.
Well, they're actually helping us out by putting parentheses around their names as well, or identifying themselves as Jews. I mean, that's got to be the funniest thing.
The line they used was, we want to keep it balanced and Zionist in nature.
Right, Dennis, we're pretty much coming to the end of the podcast now. We've been talking about both your series here. If you want to let people know where they can find you on YouTube and your websites before we finish.
Yeah, it's Adolf Hitler, the Greatest Story Never Told .tv for the first documentary, and for the second one, coming in by the back door, you can catch that on Dennis Wise YouTube. I think there's 19 parts up there, and 20 is in the making.
Okay, well, go and check it out. Thank you very much for coming on once again, Dennis. Thank you very much, Messerschmitt, for your presentation. Thank you, listeners, for listening. There'll be part two of Messerschmitt's Leon de Grel next week. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next Friday at the same time, at the same place, on Radio Area.
tuned into Radio Aryan.